It's an odd feeling to know that the Republican Party of Minnesota's state convention is taking place right now in Duluth, and I am not there. I got involved with the Republican Party back in 2010 as a natural outgrowth of my activism within the Tea Party movement. And I've gone to every single Republican Party of Minnesota state convention since. This is the first one that I have not attended since 2010. And I'm kind of conflicted about it. I kind of went back and forth in terms of whether or not I was going to find a way to somehow get up there. It looked like a couple of times this week that I might have been able to figure it out. But in the final analysis, I opted to just stay home, spend some time, some valuable time with the family, which nowadays with this commitment here with you guys on weeknights, 9 to 11, coupled with the day job, time with the family is far and few between. So I decided that was a little bit more valuable than going up and hobnobbing and flaunting a press credential in Duluth. But nevertheless, I think it's worth our time this evening to reflect upon what's happened. What happened in the past couple of years that changed my outlook on, you know, that basically determined that I wasn't going to be at the Republican Party convention this year. And the answer to that for longtime listeners of the program should be no surprise. And that, of course, is the transition that has taken place. And there was a story recently, apparently former Speaker of the House John Boehner made some comment to the effect, talking to a reporter, that the Republican Party no longer exists. It's Trump's party now. And we're seeing the Trump Party in action, and that the Republican Party, whatever that was, that has gone to sleep, I believe, is the terminology that John Boehner used. And I think there's a truth to that. You know, I know people aren't big fans of John Boehner, but, you know, lest we forget, while John Boehner was Speaker of the House, a lot of us liked Paul Ryan, myself included. You know, Paul Ryan, you know, as just a member of the House from Wisconsin, not in leadership, looked like one of the conservative stars of that body. And indeed he was. On the merits, he was. Absolutely. There was nobody, with the possible exception of, you know, the Freedom Caucus and Ron Paul and those guys, there was nobody who you might characterize as being part of the, quote, establishment, unquote, who did more to argue against entitlements and against government spending and against the national debt than Paul Ryan. Now, of course, all that changed once he assumed the responsibilities of Speaker of the House. The point that I'm trying to raise here is that it's the system and the position and the concept of leadership that basically digests an otherwise good person and kicks them out the other end as something unrecognizable and undesirable. That's what happened to Paul Ryan. It's also, to a large degree, what happened to John Boehner. So I think dismissing Boehner's characterization or his observation out of hand just because it's coming from Boehner is a mistake. And what does Boehner mean when he says it's Trump's party now? It's no longer the Republican Party. The Republican Party doesn't exist. Well, from my perspective, I can tell you that going back to 2012, or actually 2016, I'm sorry, the last time I attended the Republican Party Minnesota State Convention, I did so with a sense of urgency, because at that point, it was about this same time in the year, at that point in the presidential campaign, it was beginning to look very much like Donald Trump was going to be our nominee. And for me and a number of other prominent activists within the party, that was a big problem. It was an existential threat to the Republican Party. We were concerned, and we went to the State Central Committee meeting that year, and I got up as a spokesman of a group of activists that was working to put forward a resolution that would have enabled or affirmed, it would have enabled anything, actually. It was kind of a gesture of symbolism to affirm the freedom of conscience amongst delegates and party officers to choose whom they would support on the ticket. So in other words, if you had somebody who you were supporting for state legislature, or if you had somebody who you were supporting for a particular congressional district, or whatever it was that was bringing you to the party, you could still be a part of that and simply not, you know, the undertone to it, or the implication of it was, you don't have to be for Trump in order to be a Republican. That was the idea that we're trying to get across. To communicate to activists in an official capacity from the top of the party on down that we understand if you have a problem with this guy, you can still be one of us. You can still call yourself a Republican. That resolution was resoundingly defeated. And ever since then, a prerequisite for calling yourself a Republican amongst many within our party has been unquestioning, undying personal loyalty to the man of Donald Trump. And that, if I could summarize the change from what was before to what is now, that's it. We are no longer a party that is rallied around principle. We are no longer a party that is based upon ideas. We are a party that is dictated to from the top down by one man and defined by one man and what he says and what he thinks and what he believes ought to be done to the exclusion of everything else. And, you know, if you want evidence to back that up, just look at every single primary election that's taken place since. Look at all the endorsement contests. Look at what the candidates are saying on the campaign trail. Jeff Johnson, a guy who I know, you know, and have known since back when I first got involved with the party during my Tea Party days. You know, he's been around for a long time. He's probably going to end up being endorsed this weekend to be the next governor from the state of Minnesota to head to challenge whoever the DFL puts up in November. This guy has, you know, he's positioning himself to be at least Trump acceptable, because that's a requirement in the party now. But he was never a Trump guy. He was never somebody who was Trump-like prior to the ascendancy of Trump, right? You know, he was always a principled, you could almost describe him as Tea Party. He's always been an activist favorite. He's always been a guy who's understood what conservatism is, how it applies to the real world, how it applies to the task of governance. And this is what makes him popular amongst Republican activists. But even he, in his effort to secure the endorsement in the Minnesota GOP today, has to make a big deal out of the fact that Trump is great. I support Trump. Trump is so awesome. Aren't we lucky to have Trump? And one of his primary lines of attack against Tim Pawlenty is that Tim Pawlenty had bad things to say about Trump in 2016. And so that's supposed to haunt Pawlenty going into a primary challenge this year in 2018. And it will. It absolutely will be a factor. And that is what has changed between then and now. Then it used to be about, well, what do you think? What are your ideas? What is it that you support in terms of policy? You know, what are your core beliefs? What's your philosophy? Those were the questions that people asked back in the day, a couple of years ago. Today, the only question the first and foremost question that somebody's interested in is, where do you stand on Trump? Do you support the president? What did you say in 2016 during the election? And was that supportive of our president? And that's all we care about as a Republican Party today. I think that's a shame. I think that's something that I think we've lost something incredibly significant. And indeed, that primarily was the fear going into the convention 2 years ago, when that group of activists that I served as a spokesman for was looking to do something in order to salvage the situation. You know, and in spite of the fact that, against my prognostication, Trump went on to secure the election and to beat Hillary Clinton, and has gone on to have successes in his administration and has done a lot of good things, for which I've praised him over this very air. In spite of all of that, the core fear has still manifested, has still become a reality. And that core fear is that the Republican Party would change with Donald Trump as its standard bearer. The Republican Party would become something other than what it had been before. And that has happened. And in some cases, it's resulted in, quite frankly, the death of local parties. One example coming out of Politico. the state that spawned the Reagan Revolution and Richard Nixon just experienced a watershed moment. The California Republican Party was officially relegated to third party status. In the culmination of the withered state GOP's long slide toward near political irrelevance in California, new voter registration data released this week show the once robust party trails behind both Democrats and no party preference in the nation's most populous state. The California Republican Party is now outnumbered by independent voters by 73,000, according to the Political Data Inc., which tabulates voter file data from county registrars. The new figures come as the state looms large in the national battle for the House, with a handful of Republican-held seats poised to play a pivotal role in November. Among California's 19 million registered voters, the latest statistics, as of 15 days before June 5th primary, show that Democrats now make up 8.4 million, or 44.6% of the electorate. That compares with 4,844,803 no-party preference voters, or 25.5% of the state's voters, and a similar number of Republicans who make up about 25.1%. So again, the voters who identify as Republican in California are now fewer than those who opt for no party preference. That's the state of things. Now, you know, you might look at that and say to yourself, well, that's California, right? Of course, they're weirdos. Of course, it's going to be like that in Cali. Well, yeah, look, I'm not going to take umbrage with the characterization as California is a strange place that I don't want to live in because of its politics, although Minnesota ain't that far behind. And indeed, Minnesota isn't all that far behind. Look at what the current state of the Republican Party of Minnesota is. Now, it's come far since its lowest point a few years back. You know, there has been recovery, there's been paying off of debt, there's been a successful defense of the party's endorsement in a number of contested races over the past few years. But this year is potentially going to present a rather large exception to that, with Tim Pawlenty's run straight to the primary and skipping the convention this weekend. And, you know, if he prevails, that's going to be a major ding on the strength, the perceived and actual strength of the state party. And from all accounts, it has already started to be drained intentionally by donors who don't want to donate to it. You know, and look, you can say, well, that's just because the establishment types are supporting Tim Pawlenty and they're taking their money and putting it behind him. Yes, you're right. You're correct. That's absolutely true. But that doesn't answer the question of why. And, you know, whether you agree with their reasons for why or not, the fact remains, they don't see the value in doing things the old-fashioned way. They don't see the value in supporting the Republican Party and supporting the endorsed candidate. They see value in circumventing all that and going straight to a primary with Tim Pawlenty. That says something about the state of the party as such and the direction that it has gone, and whether or not it's going to be able to be successful, not necessarily this year or in 2020, but in terms of generational trajectory, 10 years down the road, 20 years down the road. And I like to be concerned with long-term stuff. I think it's kind of relevant, kind of important to think beyond tomorrow. Closing argument. My name's Walter Hudson. Hey, it's Freelance Friday tonight, so you can call in and take the show in any direction you want. 651-989-5855. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com.
Did I say Freelance Friday?
Making it up as we go along, Friday.
I'll tell you what. It's supposed to be freestyle. But see, this is why we have Freestyle Fridays, because by the time I get to Friday, the brain is just gone. Like, there's nothing there. Nothing's happening. Neurons are firing in random directions. I just can't keep it together. So I need you guys to help me out, help provide content, stability, and direction for the program. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, 651-989-5855 is the number to call in and contribute. And steer us in any direction you fancy, willing to. And there's a very, very broad spectrum of subjects we're willing to cover on a Friday night. So you are most welcome to join us. News just over the break, just in my email box, got a little ping from the Republican Party of Minnesota. Nearly 1,700 delegates came together on Friday night at the Duluth Entertainment Convention Center to endorse candidates for United States Senate. Representative Jim Neuberger from Becker was endorsed for the United States Senate seat with nearly 80% of the vote on the first ballot for the Senate seat currently held by Amy Klobuchar. He said, "I am humbled, honored, and gracious to receive the endorsement. I will do everything in my power to do what is needed to win this seat." As somebody who's known Jim for a number of years now, quite a few years, and knew him even before he was a state representative, when he was just a lowly local Tea Party coordinator and BPOU guy up there in his neck of the woods, I can tell you, I believe him 100% when he says he's going to do everything he can to win this. And if he prevails, I imagine that to the extent his staff lets him, he'll be every bit as generous with his time that he has been with us. You know, we just had him on for an hour earlier this week as part of our campaign week interview blitz. And he's a guy who will always make time to do that kind of thing. I wish him the best and congratulate him. All right, let's...
Are they endorsing for governor tomorrow?
I'm not sure. Okay. I have not looked at the agenda. I imagine we'll probably, before this show is out, or before this show's done tonight, we'll probably see another press release regarding the other Senate race, because they did say... the way you could tell that they rushed out the email, because the subject line was endorses candidates, plural, and then they only announced Jim Neuberger, right? So I imagine the other one's coming. Now, Neuberger, as they mentioned, is running for the seat currently held by Amy Klobuchar, the other seat under contention this year in a strange set of circumstances resulting from Al Franken's troubles with ladies' bottoms, so to speak. Well, literally.
I don't think he has troubles with them.
As Tina Smith's seat, which is also open, and there's going to be an endorsement for that as well, so we'll probably see that, unless that one, for some reason, devolves into like a five-ballot drama, which seems really highly unlikely to me. I can't imagine there's going to be too much strong contention over whether or not Karen Housley's going to end up getting the endorsement.
Do we know how many delegates there are voting?
No. And that's a great question, because it is a Friday night. It is the night before the main event, so to speak. And so, you know, they're likely to... Neuberger was telling me during one of the breaks when we had him on here earlier this week that the party had intentionally scheduled State Central for today as kind of an incentive to get delegates up there so that there would be somebody to actually vote for the endorsement in the Senate races. And so I would guess if I was going to spitball it, probably about a third of the delegates. So, I mean, they said 1,700. I don't know if they mean that 1,700 showed up or 1,700 are going to be their total.
Ah, okay. Well, the governor's endorsement race tomorrow is going to be interesting, I think.
Yes.
Because you need 60% to gain the endorsement, correct?
60% of, yeah, the... I'm trying to recall exactly how they measure it. I believe it's 60% of the seated delegates.
So the ones that are there.
Right.
Okay.
So quorum is a different consideration. In order to even have a convention, you have to have a certain number to meet quorum. But once quorum has been established, the 60% threshold drops to whatever number is actually seated.
Okay.
Well, I believe.
It's
going
to be interesting because, according to the poll that we ran this week, we got responses from 36 delegates.
Okay.
And Jeff Johnson received 21 votes, which is 58.3%. So he's right on the line of 60%.
Yeah.
Mary Giuliani Stevens got 4 for 11%. Philip Parrish got 2 for 5%. Mm. Paul Lente got 4 for 11%. And undecided is 5%.
Now, unscientific poll, of course. But I believe that's probably fairly indicative of how things are going to go.
Yeah.
I mean, it sounds instinctively like that's how it's going to go down. And it wouldn't be at all surprising to see in a four-person race that there will be, because there's three of them in attendance, the ones that we interviewed this week. And then I guess, I don't know if this Lance Johnson guy that I heard mention of over the last weekend is going to be in attendance as well. But, you know, 3-4-person races, it shouldn't be at all surprising if there's more than one ballot, you know, for governor.
Right.
Especially considering the potential of there being some kind of subversive efforts to try to push for no endorsement. If there is a candidate in the race who people are steering delegates toward for that purpose, then we'll probably know on the first ballot, because they'll show up with a big blip. And the second ballot will be the telling one in terms of the direction momentum is going. That's the way things tend to go with these convention processes. You know, it's stuff like that I'm interested in. I think you have a little bit of interest in. I don't know that the broader public does.
Well, it just goes to show that how hotly things are contested now. Even we talk about conflict among the Democrats. Like, mm-hmm. This exists among Republicans too. We're both playing the same game in our own courts.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And you know, one of the lessons that I've come to, or I don't know if a lesson is the proper way to characterize it, but you know, one of the truths that I've come to accept over my years of activism is, you know, early on I bought into, as many people do, this notion of this, some sort of mythically pure, virtuous grassroots that is perpetually at odds with a quasi-demonic establishment that's trying to keep them down and what have you. The truth of the matter is that everybody involved in these processes is doing what they believe is the best thing for the party and for the state and for the nation. They're all working, you know, whether it's the big money donors who write huge checks to the party and to candidates, or it's your grandma going out and walking in a parade, or putting up your uncle putting up lawn signs, or whatever the case may be. Across the board, everybody's doing what they believe is the best thing for the party and for the state moving forward in order to advance their principles and their values. That doesn't mean everybody's right in terms of what it is that they're advocating for or how they're advocating for it. But you know, I think the party would be stronger, and our culture would be stronger, if we were a little bit more willing to grant assumptions of good faith to people who are participating, rather than just assuming that the guy who disagrees with me is an evil, vile person. That's what the left does, and that's why so many people hate the left and hate social justice warriors, and there's been this big backlash against, in the culture war, against political correctness. You know, as soon as the Democrats realize that isn't getting them anywhere and they actually reform, which I don't know if they're capable of, but as soon as they do that, they start to win hands down every time over time, because they already have the perceived moral high ground in terms of how they argue for things in the public discourse. And the thing that turns everybody off is their sense of entitlement and arrogance. If they're able to shed that and have the perceived moral high ground, forget about it. So, you know, we got to beat them to it by getting that twofer going over on the conservative side. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson. We're anticipating a call from Jamar, who for some reason is up in Duluth at the Republican Party convention rather than in Rochester at the Democratic one. We're going to get a report live from the floor with Jamar here momentarily, expecting his call anytime. 651-989-5855. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. Republican Karen Housley harshly attacks Senator Tina Smith Friday night as she worked to nail down the GOP's backing to run against her this fall, while Smith, at her own party convention in Rochester, trained criticism at President Donald Trump instead. That from the Star Tribune. Closing argument. My name's Walter Hudson. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. You can catch us streaming at TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com and on your iHeartRadio app. We're here 9 to 11 weeknights. It's great having you with us. Any moment now, we're expecting a call from Jamar, who, despite being the resident lefty here at Twin Cities News Talk, is nonetheless up in Duluth at the Republican Party convention. That's going to be my first question for him, is why are you there, dude?
Is it like a coming out party?
If I knew he was going to be there, that might have been the thing that tipped me over to actually go up this weekend. So I'm kind of glad I didn't know, because it'll be more more fulfilling, I think, overall to spend the weekend with my family. But it would have been fun to hang out with him up there in that environment and kind of protect him a little bit. I think he might need a bodyguard. I think he might need somebody to keep the wolves off. If the reaction on social media to the picture he posted, he took a picture in the convention lobby with like the stuffed elephant, whatever its name is. That's the mascot of the Republican Party in Minnesota. And that went up on social media, and he just got rabid attacks from, you know, a bunch of conservatives being like, "What are you doing?" It's like, calm down, guys. Just relax. It's can you have some fun with the guy? I mean, you know, I've been over this air screaming and yelling at him, you know, and he's been doing the same. So I know, you know how I feel about what he thinks and what he advocates for in public policy. But he's still a human being, for the love of God. We can at least welcome him when he wants to hang out with us. At any rate, continuing with the Star Tribune. By the way, 651-989-5855, the number to join us this evening if you're so inclined. Freestyle Friday, you can steer the conversation whatever direction you want, whether it's something I've been talking about or not. Brad Omland takes those calls and produces the show. At dueling political conventions the same weekend, Minnesota Republicans and DFLers gathered to endorse candidates for what promises to be the most significant election cycle in the state in decades. The main order of business Friday night was endorsing candidates in two Senate races, both a special election to fill the seat left open by Al Franken and the seat that DFL Senator Amy Klobuchar is seeking for a third term. Both conventions are still going, and delegates had yet to officially confer their endorsements for the special Senate election, but Housley, a state senator from the Stillwater area, and Smith, a former lieutenant governor and DFL operative, were favored to win party backing. In her speech to delegates, Housley signaled an aggressive campaign style with a slashing attack against Smith. She blasted her for obstructing initiatives sought by Trump, for her service in the administration of DFL Governor Mark Dayton, and for her views on immigration. She puts the well-being of illegal immigrants above the American people, Housley said in her speech. Smith, who faces a DFL primary opponent this August in former Bush White House lawyer and cable news regular Richard Painter, did not mention Housley in her speech. Instead, she trained her criticism on Trump as she vowed to take on drug companies that are overcharging people, increase mental health services in schools, protect immigrants, fight for net neutrality, and remove dark money from elections. What's the through line between the remarks offered by Housley and the remarks offered by Smith? Now, we had Karen Housley on the program here earlier this week, and my exposure to her has been overwhelmingly positive. I like her. I was impressed by her candor and humility when she talked about her handling of a bill in the state legislature that came up as a response to the Me Too movement that was meant to change the way the state approaches sexual harassment in the workplace. And the story she shared with us earlier this week when she was on the program was that, you know, the purpose of the bill, or one of the mechanisms of the bill, was to take out this language that I believe it was severe and pervasive out of current statute. So in other words, in order to get a conviction or to make headway on an accusation of sexual harassment under current law, you have to demonstrate that the action, the offensive activity, is both severe and pervasive. And that's, of course, that's a completely subjective term, right? Like, at what point does it become severe? At what point does it become pervasive? And the argument from folks who were advocating Housley's bill was that the courts have taken a very conservative approach to the definition of severe and pervasive, such that, you know, you might have to endure being groped for 6 months before they would actually decide that, okay, you've crossed the invisible line that we've drawn as a court as to what constitutes severe and pervasive. So the solution, the prescribed solution to this was, well, let's just get rid of that language. The problem with that, though, as I see it, and as many other folks saw in institutions such as colleges, community colleges, municipalities, and businesses, was that if you just take out that language and you don't replace it with something more precise and more objective, then you're opening the floodgates to sexual harassment claims based upon absolutely nothing, based upon the subjective judgment of the alleged victim at any given moment, no matter what the behavior is. You know, as long if they call it sexual harassment, then it's going to have to be taken seriously, or it could potentially be taken seriously under the revamped law. And so when that was pointed out to Karen Housley, she took the point and she backed off and she said, you know what, maybe we need to take more time because it was the end of session. Maybe we need to take this back to the drawing board and come back and take a fresh look at it when we have more time to deliberate the best way to approach it. That takes humility, and I was really impressed by that. Be that as it may, aside from the fact that I like her, aside from the fact that she exhibits characteristics that I think would be very helpful in public office, the fact that one of her big highlights in this speech to delegates was to talk about illegal immigration, the through line between that and all the things that Tina Smith listed off is government force. It's advocacy for government force. The only difference is who it's going to be used against and who it's going to benefit by using it against whoever you're using it against. In other words, who are the victims and who are the victors? Who is going to receive the plunder and who is going to be plundered? That's really the only difference between the substance of the rhetoric here. Now, overall, all things considered, the Democrats, of course, and the left, of course, is much worse in that regard than the Republicans are. But be that as it may, I'm really excited for the potential of one day in the future, in a time that is going to have to come after the era we're currently in, where the Republican Party distinguishes itself not by having a different constituency that it serves with the force of the state, but by opposing the force of the state overall, period, by advocating for liberty, by advocating for self-governance and a institutional government which has the purpose of ensuring that people's ability to self-govern is maintained and that they go unmolested in their pursuit of happiness. Wouldn't that be nice? Speaking of, a gentleman by the name of Tony, I'm not going to share his full name here because he's not a public figure and this post on Facebook was not a public post, but he's up there in Duluth right now at the state convention, which actually surprises me because he's a libertarian and I believe he's right on the border of, you know, these folks who want to remove their consent from the process. So I'm kind of actually surprised that he's up there in Duluth right now. But he took a picture of a barrier on a sidewalk up there, you know, one of these folding orange and white striped placards with a flashing orange light on top of it, with a sign taped on it that says First Amendment Zone. And then there's an area that's been barricaded on the sidewalk. Now, this is presumably right outside of, he tagged it as being outside the Duluth Entertainment Convention Center. So apparently we have a First Amendment Zone up there at the Republican Party of Minnesota. And I imagine that's to contain the, you know, potential DFL or left-leaning protesters that might show up to this thing. And, you know, here are my thoughts on this. I don't have a problem with what this is, like the idea that we're going to cordon off an area for people to protest in. And because we have rented out this space and we've rented it out for a purpose, and that purpose is not to facilitate protest of ourselves, right, which would be pretty ridiculous, we're going to carve out a spot where it's designated that anybody who wants to protest can do so publicly and be seen. That makes total sense to me from a security perspective, from an operational perspective, and in terms of the all the rights involved. They have the right to do that. What I object to is calling it a First Amendment zone, because it perpetuates this false idea that the First Amendment has anything whatsoever to do with how you conduct yourself on private property or when engaging in relationships with private individuals and private organizations, which the Republican Party of Minnesota is private. It's a little counterintuitive, but truthfully, they're a private organization that has rented out a facility, and the facility is not owned by the protesters, right? So the owner of the facility and the people who they have delegated their rights to in the form of the lessee or the renter, those are the people who get to decide what happens on that property. It's not a free speech issue that they're cordoning off an area for people to go protest. That's a matter of private policy. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, 651-989-5855. TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. I maintain that social media is in something of an adolescence, or perhaps more precisely, that our culture of social media is in its adolescence. And by that, I mean, it's still maturing and we haven't grown up yet. We haven't got to the point yet where we truly understand the best way to use this technology to actually enhance our quality of life. And, you know, just like any adolescent or teenager who is just discovering the full extent of their power, just discovering, you know, what they're capable of and are stretching their legs and pushing their boundaries and expanding their horizons, we are eager to see what we can do, eager to see what we can accomplish, and eager to act, eager to do whatever pops into our head on social media without thinking through the consequences. And this is we kind of have reached, I don't know if a pinnacle has it been achieved yet, but I think we're approaching a point where something major is going to change. And I'm not enough of a futurist to be able to forecast exactly what that something is going to be. But I want to use this whole Roseanne thing to kind of paint the picture of what the context is that's going to require some kind of change. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, 651-989-5855. So there's a piece over at MarketWatch that talks about Roseanne's predicament and says that, like Roseanne, this is the headline, all Americans are just one bad tweet away from being fired. If you use Twitter, you too are a public figure, and one egregious tweet could blow up your life. On Tuesday, ABC canceled the wildly successful reboot of Roseanne after Roseanne Barr wrote a racist tweet about Valerie Jarrett, a former advisor in Barack Obama's White House. Barr apologized, but the damage was done. Several members of her cast and ABC executives denounced her. The cancellation of Barr's show came some 11 hours after she sent the original tweet. That's astounding. There wasn't a day of deliberation. There wasn't 12 hours of deliberation. 11 hours after the tweet, her show was canceled. Roseanne's Twitter statement is abhorrent, repugnant, and inconsistent with our values, and we've decided to cancel her show, Channing Dungey, president of ABC Entertainment, who is black, said in a statement. ICM Partners, talent agency, also dropped Barr. So she lost her show. She lost her agent. The swiftness of ABC's response is a testament to diversity in the C-suite and the speed with which news travels on social media, says Aram Sinrich, professor of communications at the American University in Washington, D.C. It helps that there's an African-American woman calling the shots, he said. It also reflects that in the Trump age, the news cycle has accelerated so quickly that there's a vanishingly small window for commercial entities to get out in front of these damaging public relations incidents. The ability to bury these kinds of stories has diminished to almost zero. This wasn't Barr's first racist tweet, so why now? The political climate is putting all employers on high alert when it comes to the words and behavior of their employees, Sinrich said. We're understood to be private citizens, but when someone is in the public face of a public corporation, that corporation should and must be held accountable for the actions of that individual, he said. Sinrich says some people are frustrated with the lack of consequences when President Trump tweets racially tinged statements. Until the president is held accountable for the outrageous volume of hate speech that he generates, proxies are going to continue to come under the gun, according to this guy at the American University in Washington, D.C. So here's my take on this. And it's not so much about the tweet itself, or, you know, we talked last night about the double standard. A lot of conservatives are crying foul because of the treatment of Roseanne when compared to the slap on the wrist that somebody like a Michelle Wolf gets, or somebody like Samantha Bee, you know, who apologized for using a very derogatory and offensive word to describe Ivanka Trump recently. You know, the difference in treatment between conservatives and liberals, which let me just pause to note that I think we ought to object to Roseanne Barr being considered a conservative. Like, she's a, why is she a conservative?
She's about as conservative as Donald Trump.
You know what I'm saying? Like, what is it about her that makes her a conservative? What's her policy on, I don't know, healthcare? Like, has she talked about any of the actual policy positions? Has she ever, you know, gone on about her political philosophy or talked about the importance of individual rights or fiscal responsibility? I'm not sure what it is other than being a fan of Trump and saying nice things about Trump that qualifies her as conservative, but be that as it may.
If anything, she's a Green Party member because that's how she ran for president.
There you go.
But she did endorse Donald Trump last year, I guess, so that's
she's,
why.
She's much more in line with like a Jesse Ventura than she is with, you know, a rank-and-file Republican.
Like Paul Ryan.
Yeah, exactly. But be that as it may, the in the public space, the perception is that Roseanne's the conservative here, and Samantha Bee and Michelle Wolf and others are the lefties. So is there a double standard between how, the way these guys are treated? Absolutely, of course there is. But I'm more interested in another aspect of this, and that is what it signals, the ability of somebody to get fired within 11 hours of a tweet, right? And for their entire career to collapse. What that signals about our future and the future of your kids who are coming up right now with Twitter accounts and Facebook accounts and are getting ready to go into the workplace, how is anybody going to be able to get or keep a job if this is the standard? If you can lose it just like that because of something dumb you said on Twitter. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. As of yet, at least that I can discern, as to how the race for Republican endorsement for U.S. Senate to challenge Tina Smith is going. We do have an endorsed candidate to challenge Amy Klobuchar. That is Jim Neuberger, who you heard on this very air earlier in the week. And that should be an interesting race to follow. Now it's going to be interesting to see whether or not the donors kick in and there whether there's a primary challenge. I don't think there's going to be one. I think all the candidates who are, well, I don't know how many challengers Neuberger had. One that I know of, possibly two, but I'm pretty sure they said they were going to abide by the endorsement. And when you get 80% of the delegates voting for you on the first ballot, pretty clear indication that your primary challenge probably isn't going to go anywhere if you're looking to challenge that. So it'll be interesting to see if the campaign kicks into a new gear now that he's secured endorsement. No word as of yet, though, as to who is going to be challenging Tina Smith in the general election. Closing argument. My name's Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. Catch us streaming at TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com and on your iHeartRadio app. We're here 9 to 11 weeknights. Appreciate you joining us. It is Friday night, and that means Freestyle Friday. We'll take the show in any direction you want to go. 651-989-5855 is the number to join us. Brad Ullman takes those calls and produces the program. So at the bottom of the last hour, we got into talking about or just reviewing the state of the cultural moment that we find ourselves in, as indicated by the fate of Roseanne Barr and the cancellation of her show, which apparently was popular, apparently a lot of people liked, and yet ABC couldn't wait 12 full hours between when she issued her tweet that's been described as a racist tweet regarding Valerie Jarrett and canceling her show. And the question that I have going forward is, because, you know, over at MarketWatch, they have this article that says, look, this could happen to you. It's not just Roseanne. Anybody is one bad tweet away from being fired. And I think that's true. I think that's accurate. It presents you with a moment of pause, right? But then, you know, when you think about it, haven't we all said things, posted things on social media to wonder, it might not have been as bad as what Roseanne Barr tweeted out, But haven't we all said things that, especially if they were, you know, like in a closed group or in a private message or on Messenger or something along those lines, that if it were to come to light, could be regarded or twisted into being just as bad as what she did and result in our firing? I think the answer to that is probably yes, across the board, with like 80, 85, 90% of people. So at some point, it occurs to me that we're going to have to come up with a new kind of etiquette or a new kind of protocol for how we deal with social media. Because as it stands right now, you know, this idea of you go apply for a job and your potential employer Googles you or looks at your Facebook page and sees something, you know, you got kids who have grown up with social media at this point. Certainly in the next, well, through their formative years, and within the next 10 years, you'll have kids who have never existed in a world that didn't have social media who are going to be going into the workplace. And they have the curse of coming of age during social media's adolescence, and therefore, you know, having no discipline, because as a culture, we don't really have much discipline regarding how we use social media as of yet. That's going to have to develop, and I believe it will develop. I don't know exactly how, but it has to come at some point, because we can't just have this situation, you know, to the extent that anybody cares about equity, to the extent that anybody cares about equal treatment. You can't have a scenario where one person is getting fired because of something they tweeted and another person is not, right? There has to be a standard. And in the lack of that standard, eventually what's going to end up happening is somebody's going to file a lawsuit, or some group of people is going to end up filing a class action lawsuit as a result of firings taking place in response to social media. And that's probably one of the mechanisms by which the new etiquette will eventually come about.
Well, that I think it will hopefully get to a point, maybe this is being too optimistic, but it will get to the point where somebody will share a private message and it will be like, okay, they said that to you in a reasonable level of confidence.
Right.
And the expectation that their conversation would be private.
Right.
And so even though, yeah, it might be controversial, we're gonna let him go this time,
right,
because he didn't say it. But I think a lot of the stuff that's coming out now is just way too salacious, and we just can't control ourselves in our reaction to it.
You're absolutely right. It's a two-way street, and you know, we need to come to an understanding of social media. Even though it's a virtual space, we need to somehow develop an appreciation for the fact that not all virtual space is equal. So in other words, in real life, when I'm at school, right, let's say I work at a school or I'm a teacher or whatever the case may be, or, you know, I just any job at the workplace, you conduct yourself in a certain way in terms of how you present yourself, the language you use, the cadence with which you speak, the behaviors which are considered to be acceptable in the workplace. Later on that night, you go to the bar. And it's a totally different set of rules, right? Like, what is considered acceptable in that space in terms of how the language you use, how you speak, the way you carry yourself is completely different. You're operating under a different set of social rules. And so it would be ridiculous if you were to go into work the next day and your boss were to come up to you and be like, hey, when you were at the bar last night, you said X, right? In the context of just being, you're in a public space, you're at a bar, anybody can overhear you, right? But if your boss came up to you and said, you said this when you were at the bar last night, so now you're fired. What are you talking about? I was on my own time. I was not here. I was not representing the company. How dare you? You don't have the right to do that. You don't have the right to tell me how to behave in my private space. That concept, we need to develop a social understanding that applies that concept to the virtual space of social media. Because this idea that, you know, once you become the face of a corporation, which you could make the argument that any employee, anybody who has on their Facebook profile, this is where I work, is to some extent a public face of that company. So what? So now that your company now has ownership of how you get to behave and what you get to say and what positions you get to take?
I think that companies do try to take ownership of that now.
Absolutely. But the reason they're doing so is because they're operating under a paradigm that tells them they must or that they should. And there's this expectation that's, again, fueled by social media that, well, you know, you should do something Starbucks. You should do something Amazon. You should respond ABC to what Roseanne Barr tweeted. And you ought to do it now. Now, not later. Don't tell me, oh, we're going to look into that. Don't investigate it. Don't find out what the real motive was. We want action now. Not in 12 hours, but in 11. Right? Certainly not in a day. Certainly not in a week. We want the reaction right now, and we want it to fulfill our immediate mob mentality desire to see some form of vengeance against this person who offended us. That's the environment in which these companies, such as ABC, are making their employment decisions, and that's not sustainable. Because you're going to get to a point, it's kind of like with the Me Too thing. The Me Too thing has the potential to get dialed up to the point where boys aren't going to ask girls out because they're going to be terrified that they'll be labeled a sex criminal because they did so, right? Like there has to be, even though there's a legitimate complaint at the kernel of what you're concerned about, there you have to have some sense of perspective in terms of how to react to it. And that's largely lacking in our culture right now. And I think it's part of this adolescence of social media and something that's going to need to change over time. Dan's ears must have been burning over there in Minnetonka because it looks like he wants to talk about exactly what I was going to transition to next. Dan, welcome to the program.
My ears are on fire. Or maybe it's Famous Dave's that I've just eaten. No, I don't know. But, you're not laughing. No, I'm just kidding. You know, Keith Ellison says he's going to boycott the NFL because
right,
they're coming down on players who are making political protests,
right,
as employees.
Yep.
You know, against the American flag, which represents, you know, what's that? Liberty and justice for all.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
A guy's a nutcase. I don't know what to say. I'm not surprised. I wonder if we were to maybe do political rants against the left on the football field about, you know, massive welfare handouts, corruption, et cetera. And, you know, every time...
Yeah, I mean, what if it was white players who were taking a knee to protest welfare, right? Like, the narrative would be completely different. It would be, how dare you? How dare you politicize football? This is a disgrace. And there would be calls for the league to do something about that.
Right. His political speech is only when it pertains to what he believes in.
Right.
Now, if you're protesting the subjugation of women in Islam, or you know,
right,
or something else like the mutilation of women,
right,
or you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, or you just thought it was just a stupid religion and you were protesting Islam at football games, I'm sure he would want you to be fired.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, so it's so typical hypocritical from the left.
This is true. Appreciate the call, Dan. 651-989-5855. Freestyle Friday. You can take the show in any direction you want, including that one. Indeed, from the Star Tribune, Representative Keith Ellison, the Democratic congressman from Minnesota's 5th District, which is Minneapolis, had started looking ahead to the next NFL season with great anticipation. But after the league announced its new policy regarding player protests during the national anthem last week, Ellison decided on a protest of his own. Ellison said he will not watch the NFL next fall, a decision he announced over the weekend on Twitter. There you go with your social media again, while wielding the prevalent hashtag, Boycott NFL. I hope they change their mind, Ellison said. I'm a massive football fan. Well, I don't think they're going to, and I don't think they're going to miss you, Keith. Sorry, I don't think they're going to care. And I understand that the point here is twofold, right? It's the... One, it's just the political posturing of, look at me, I'm boycotting the NFL, aren't I? Winning points with the left. You know, these mythical credits for progressive virtue that apparently you get to cash in the afterlife or some sort of, you know, bonus. I don't know what that is.
Dogecoin,
right? So there's that aspect of it, and the other side is trying to inspire other people to join him in order to turn this into a thing that somehow gets the NFL to change their mind. I don't think the NFL's backing off on this, because at this point, once you've staked out a position like this, to back off of it, it's not like you're going to satisfy the people who are already ticked off at you, and you're just going to tick off the people who actually like what you did. So I imagine they're going to stay firm. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. I want to see if you see the same irony in this story I'm about to share with you that I do. I just found this story to be quite ironic, and you know, maybe I'm out on a limb by myself with this one. You know, maybe there's some logic to this that I'm just not perceiving and don't understand, but this just strikes me as a truly bizarre scenario here. Closing argument. My name's Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. 651-989-5855 is the number to join us. The story comes to us from the Star Tribune. An Idaho teacher accused of feeding a sick puppy to a snapping turtle. I'm going to read that again because I understand that there's this thing about the human mind where you hear something and if it's not what you're expecting, you don't catch it. So I'm going to try this one again for you. An Idaho teacher accused of feeding a sick puppy to a snapping turtle in front of several students has been charged with misdemeanor animal cruelty. Preston Junior High School science teacher Robert Crossland was charged Friday. He faces up to 6 months in jail and a $5,000 fine if convicted. The school is in rural Preston in Idaho, where the 2004 teen cult classic film Napoleon Dynamite was set. That makes perfect sense.
Yeah, it does.
I missed that part when I first read this story earlier. That's beautiful. That's just a great little tidbit.
Well, doesn't the movie Napoleon Dynamite start out with them shooting an animal in front of the school bus? Or if they shoot a cow in front of a school bus?
I don't remember that part, but I wouldn't be at all surprised if that's in there. The Idaho Attorney General's office handled the investigation after Franklin County Prosecutor Vic Pearson cited a conflict of interest, they don't follow that up with what the conflict of interest is. What possible conflict of interest could you have with a case of somebody feeding a puppy to a snapping turtle? Is he in like the turtle industry or?
It was his dog.
Maybe something along those lines. So several parents came forward to say Crossland, the teacher in question, fed the puppy to the turtle on March 7th. Here's the part that gets me. This is the great irony here. Several weeks later, state officials seized the turtle and euthanized it as a non-native species. So the state killed the turtle, right? So the guy, and I'm not saying I condone what he did, right? Like, I wouldn't do what he did.
That's really disgusting.
I wouldn't feed a sick puppy to a turtle. I wouldn't even think, I didn't know that was a thing. I didn't know turtles were into puppies. I didn't know that was like...
Snapping turtles will eat anything.
But I'm not saying it was a good idea or that he should have done it. But dude is facing 6 months in jail. I'm sure he's lost his job. A potential $5,000 fine for killing an animal. And part of the process is the state coming in and killing an animal. Like, and what this... To me, what this indicates a couple of different things. First of all, just the hypocrisy of the state gets to do what it wants and private citizens are held to a different standard. But also, culturally, we totally have a double standard when it comes to animals and animal treatment. If something is cute and fuzzy versus something being cold and scaly. And I'm right there with you, right? Like, I hate snakes. You wouldn't see me keeping a lizard or something in my house. You know, it's something that I don't encourage amongst my boys. I'm not like, you know, oh yeah, we'll get a turtle. We'll get a, I mean, turtles, whatever. I'm not particularly concerned about them. I'm pretty confident I can outrun a turtle. But, you know, I'm not too keen on having lizards and snakes and whatnot in my house. I get that. But this notion that if you're cruel to a dog, that's somehow worse than being cruel to a turtle. You're going to have to explain that to me. Like,
I remember when I was a kid, or not a kid, but when I worked as a lifeguard at the pool, there was like this deer that would come out and hang, just stare at us at the pool. And the cop came and like tried to like strangle it in front of us.
Nice.
And it was just sitting there.
Nice.
I think they assumed they thought it would hurt someone.
That actually.
But a deer could be classified as cute and cuddly.
Well, sure. That brings up another interesting aspect of the story that I am 95% confident is true. These parents who complained about the guy feeding a puppy to a turtle, none of them. This is how all the parents found out about it. Their kid came home and was like, "Mommy, mommy, mommy, I saw the most awesome thing in the world today. I saw a turtle eat a puppy." At least the boys. This is how the boys would have came home, right? The girls might have cried about it, but the boys, it was, "Daddy, daddy, daddy, I saw a turtle eat a puppy today. It was awesome." Like, they weren't traumatized. It wasn't the most horrible thing that's ever happened to them. They were excited about it. It's the parents who imposed the, oh my God, I can't believe this is happening. Something simply must be done. You know?
I don't know. I think if I saw that in real life, like somebody set that up, like, "Hey, watch this puppy, watch this turtle eat this puppy." Like, I would puke. That's gross. And, like, sick on the human's part. Like, that's just gross.
Oh, yeah, dude definitely probably should not be in any sort of position of authority.
I mean, snapping turtles are disgusting enough in themselves. Like, you see the videos on YouTube of their neck extending out and their mouth opening. It's so gross. And then to watch it eat a puppy and blood everywhere, that's disgusting.
I just can't get past the fact that the article ends with the state came in and euthanized the turtle. And it wasn't even because, like, oh, well, we're afraid that now that it's had puppy meat, it's going to go forth and hunt all the town's puppies. Like, that wasn't the argument. It was, it's a non-native species. So this is like, you know, illegal immigration or something. Like, this was like, it doesn't belong here, so we're going to haul it out and shoot it or whatever it is.
It's literally like Harrison Bergeron, the way that plot unfolds.
Yeah.
By Kurt Vonnegut.
All right. So from Vice News, there have been a couple of instances recently of Google including search results that are derogatory towards Republicans. This most recent one for Vice News, Trudy Wade is a Republican state senator from North Carolina and an enthusiastic supporter of President Trump. But if you search Trudy Wade on Google, the search giant displays an old photo in the knowledge panel of its search results with the word bigot superimposed in big red letters. It's just the latest example of Google not vetting the information that gets pulled into its knowledge panels, which are meant to give users quick information without them having to click through the search results, often on other non-Google websites. Wade declined to comment to Vice News, but a legislative aide reacted angrily to the search results, adding that the picture isn't even current. She was a bigot last year. No, like, I don't, that's an odd comment to that it's not a current picture. Google's bigot picture has surfaced as Wade was in the midst of a tough re-election battle against marketing executive and Democrat Michael Garrett. The state's district maps are redrawn for this election after several courts ruled the state had been racially gerrymandered to benefit Republicans. And they go on to later on note the earlier incident that occurred also this week, which was the Google search result in the knowledge panel associating the ideological tag Nazism with the Republican Party in a certain state. And, you know, this is not Google's fault in the sense, like, Google didn't do this on purpose, from what we can tell, but it's a situation where the information isn't going through, isn't making its way past human eyes before it ends up in search results, and so it's not being vetted, and it's causing all kinds of upheaval. The interesting thing is, though, is that I haven't seen any stories to the effect of lefties being tagged as socialists or, you know, Stalinesque or Leninites or anything along those lines. So it appears to be a one-sided phenomenon. So take that for what it's worth. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. All right. Once again, during the break, breaking news coming out of the Republican Party of Minnesota convention. Karen Housley has won the endorsement. I believe the percentage on the first ballot was 74% of the delegates voting, nearly 1,700 delegates coming together Friday night, according to a press release from the Republican Party of Minnesota. Republican Party Chairwoman Jennifer Carnahan said Republican prospects in the state of Minnesota are the brightest they've been in over a decade since Tina Smith was appointed to fill Franken's vacated seat. She has voted against the president and against the best interests of Minnesotans. We look forward to winning this seat in November. So we extend our congratulations to Karen Housley, who has been endorsed to challenge Tina Smith going forward. I don't believe she's going to end up facing a primary opponent, but we shall see. It'll probably be a bump in the road if she does. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. You can catch us streaming at TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com and on your iHeartRadio app. We are here 9 to 11 weeknights. It's great having you with us. 651-989-5855 is the number to join us. And we are doing that whole Freestyle Friday thing tonight, so you can take the show in any direction you so desire. Always appreciate your contributions. Brad Omlin taking those calls and producing the show. So there is something of a shift taking place in the culture of Disney and the culture of Star Wars in particular in the wake of the financial disappointment that was the opening weekend of Solo, A Star Wars Story. And, of course, Disney's also involved in this latest controversy involving Roseanne Barr. ABC is a Disney company. And so, in light of all this, the Washington Post has a piece talking about how Disney doesn't want to offend anybody, but is nonetheless getting caught in the middle of the culture war. From the Washington Post, almost no entertainment conglomerate aims for as wide a swath of the viewing public as the Walt Disney Company, which seeks to deliver stories, characters, and experiences that are welcomed into the hearts and homes of millions of families around the world, according to its promotional materials. Those homes have seen a lot of slammed doors lately. ABC's abrupt cancellation of Roseanne after a racist tweet from star Roseanne Barr sent many conservative voices on Wednesday into a frenzy about the politics of ABC and parent Disney. It is the latest instance in which the entertainment giant has come under fire from a wing of the American electorate, whether it's over Jimmy Kimmel, ESPN, or an episode of Black-ish. A company that has sought to position itself as a repository for all American brands, such as Star Wars and Dancing with the Stars, of basketball legends and Marvel superheroes, finds itself grappling with the realities of being a conglomerate this large in a time this divisive. We hear Disney and we think kids' movies and things that everyone just kind of loves, said Carmentia Hagenbotham, a professor at the University of Virginia, who is one of the country's leading Disney scholars. That's just, I can't, that's a sentence that actually exists. And the company likes riding the middle because that's where the money is, she said, but now they're taking all these public hits. They're going from the middle to riding the edges, and it's just starting to watch. Like the NFL, Disney has demonstrated a knack for getting pulled more deeply into controversies, even as it tries to avoid them. The controversy over Roseanne, in which Barr on Tuesday used an ugly racial image in reference to former Obama White House advisor Valerie Jarrett, prompted a swift reaction from Disney and its chief executive Robert Iger. Within hours, they canceled her show and called it the right thing to do. But what had seemed like a moment of unity in the face of hateful speech morphed on Wednesday into another partisan flashpoint. Conservative voices accused the company of taking a political position by applying a more lenient standard to liberals. The charge was led by President Trump, who tweeted that Iger apologized to Jarrett, but never called President Donald J. Trump to apologize for the horrible statements made and said about me on ABC, according to a tweet from the president. The tweet was apparently a reference to Kimmel's comments from Kimmel critical of the White House and a joke, which Kimmel would later apologize for, about Melania Trump's accent. The news made for a perfect storm, as conservative blogs had also been taking Disney to task for ESPN's rehiring of anchor Keith Olbermann, who has a track record of anti-Trump tweets. And by the way, the things Olbermann has tweeted about Donald Trump are at least as bad as the things that have been said by Roseanne Barr or anybody else. I mean, that guy has no filter whatsoever, so this is a legitimate point here. Disney executives declined to comment for this story. The one thing about this, about the conservative, there's actually a couple of things that I take umbrage with in terms of how conservatives overall have reacted to this development with the whole Roseanne story. The first is that instead of advocating for a world where we just brush these things off our shoulder, we just let it roll off our back, and we're not constantly reacting emotionally to things that offend us. Like, I'm not saying don't be offended, but what I'm saying is that, like, put it in perspective, right? Like, I get offended just like anybody else when I come across something that I disagree with, or I come across something that is opposed to my values or my value system. But there's this skill that a person learns, that adults used to learn, wherein you don't let it move into your soul and set up residence and take over your whole behavioral scheme and determine how you're going to act moving forward, and where you can't get sleep at night because you're so concerned about something Roseanne tweeted, right? Like, there's a certain level of perspective that a healthy human being ought to have about these things that a lot of people currently don't. And I really wish that Donald Trump and other people on the right side of the political spectrum were making that argument of why does somebody have to get fired every time something stupid is said, rather than making the argument of, well, you didn't call me and apologize to me when, you know, it's because that's not the world I want to live in. I don't want to live in a world where you have to apologize every time somebody's offended, right? Like, that's not it shouldn't be the aim that we're driving for. So that's the first part of the reaction to the Roseanne stuff that kind of rubs me the wrong way. The other half of it is kind of the denial of the inappropriate nature of what Roseanne expressed. You know, and I understand, we had a caller last night who tried to make the case that, well, Roseanne didn't really know that Valerie Jarrett is black. Okay, maybe. I don't know. It's possible. It is. But there are certain comparisons. There are certain imagery that you should just inherently know is not a good idea. Pulling out the Planet of the Apes card and playing it and being like, "What, race is me?" isn't the best play. And I have a hard time giving you the benefit of the doubt when that's the imagery you go to. And, you know, I have no idea whether there's, you know, racism, malignant racism festering in the heart of Roseanne Barr. Ultimately, I don't care, and I wish the rest of the world didn't either. But be that as it may, as a public relations issue, you know, she is a public figure with a public persona that has relationships that she needs to manage. And, you know, as a mature adult in that context, there are certain things that you properly ought to steer clear of in terms of how you express yourself. And I wish that that's something that conservatives were saying as well, by and large. But, you know, I, on the same time, on the other side of the coin, I get why that's not the argument on some level. I understand why, in the context where conservatives are constantly under assault and constantly being called racist and sexist, and in the left is crying wolf all the time, that's really what's taking place here. It's the boy who cried wolf effect of, because everything is considered to be racist and we're constantly being accused on a daily basis of being racist, and people on our side are being called out for being sexist and racist and bigoted and what have you, when the wolf actually shows up, when the incident of actual racism bears its ugly head, we've become so accustomed to fighting back to swapping against any sort of criticism against racism that we end up overlooking the real thing. And in that, in the process of doing so, taking ownership of something that we should not be taking ownership of. We should not be defending what Roseanne did here. Let's talk to Pete in Lake City. Welcome to the program.
Hi. I was thinking about this as you're talking about her. I remember years ago when she did that obscene thing at a baseball game, and I think this is just part of her
personality.
Herself is to be vile. Yeah,
sure.
Well, it's more than personality. It's made her a lot of money.
It's her brand.
New for her.
Yeah.
But it's a new climate.
Now. Right. No, you're absolutely right. It's something that comedians have been complaining about rightfully for quite some time. I appreciate the call, Pete. That the look, if you go back and you listen to, which I have in recent months, go back and listen to Chris Rock's early stand-up, he would be eviscerated for the jokes that he was telling 5, 10, 15 years ago by the modern day politically correct, you know, you must have the right opinion and must say the right things and never imply anything negative about black people or what have you. I mean, some of Chris Rock's early stand-up is downright scandalous by modern standards, not from like the your grandma's perspective, but from the social justice warrior progressive left point of view. And there'd be calls for him getting fired from whatever he was involved in today if it was something he had said today. 651-989-5855. Closing argument. My name's Walter Hudson. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com.
Sometimes I feel like I am drunk behind the wheel. The wheel of possibility.
So we were talking earlier in the program about that story of the teacher who fed a sick puppy to a snapping turtle in front of a bunch of kids at a school. And apparently this incident took place in the same city where they filmed Napoleon Dynamite. And Brad recalled a particular scene where a cow is shot in front of a school bus of children, which I had forgotten about. It's been so long since I watched the movie. And so during one of the breaks, he tweeted me the clip of that happening. And so I've been watching Napoleon Dynamite clips during the break. And it's, I'll tell you what, that movie should have gotten Oscars. The dude who plays Uncle Rico, like the sincerity with which he plays that character is deserving of Academy recognition. And unfortunately, we just don't live in a world that awesome.
Yeah, that's the movie I need to rewatch again because, like, before Superbad, like, Napoleon Dynamite was kind of like the go-to everybody's around, let's watch a movie.
Right. Yeah, right.
And, like, that movie, like, that was a meme before memes.
That's
on the
right.
Internet.
Yep, absolutely.
And that the part with the farmer shooting the cow in front of the kids is just life imitate. And then now in the light of this story is just
right.
Life imitating art. Like, the directors, yeah. The guys who either directed or wrote that movie were from Preston, Idaho.
Okay.
So they, like, it's funny that is now, even though the act itself, I said, is disgusting, it's funny to see that playing out in real life, like how they just pinpointed that moment.
Yeah, they weren't making it up.
In their city's culture, just casual animal cruelty.
Close the argument. My name is Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, 651-989-5855 to join us in our final segment of the week. Let's talk to Chris in Minneapolis. Welcome to the program.
Yeah, hey, Walter, how's it going?
Good.
Hey, this whole Roseanne Barr thing, the hypocrisy just gets me. There's some woman, her name escapes me now, but she had a TV show, and she called Melania Trump a...
Yeah, yeah, Samantha Bee,
And she still got her job.
Right.
But Roseanne makes it's a bad joke. It wasn't even funny.
Mm-hmm.
She shouldn't have said it, but she gets fired and loses her whole everything. The hypocrisy just it escapes me, man. I don't know what to say.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely a double standard in terms of the treatment of conservatives and liberals in Hollywood and in the culture and even in corporate culture and business. There's no doubt about that. I don't think, however, that those two incidents are apples to apples comparisons, because as horrible as what Samantha Bee said was, it was a criticism of an individual rather than than something that has broader implications of a particular group of people being somehow subhuman. I mean, when you use the imagery of an ape or Planet of the Apes in reference to black people, that's something that goes above and beyond, you know, just calling somebody a name. Even so, should
I disagree. It's not the same exact thing, but it's kind of that same area. You know what I mean?
Well, it's the same in the sense that it's offensive, and I guess being offended.
Sir.
Yeah, being offended is a subjective thing. And so I think what I hear you saying, and perhaps a lot of other people saying, is you can be just as offended by what Samantha Bee said as what somebody else is by what, or how offended somebody else is by Roseanne Barr. And that's true. And so the question becomes, and we kind of been parsing through this at different points throughout the show tonight, is offending somebody grounds for losing your job? Yeah, and that's where we're at right now, is that if you offend somebody, your career is over and you're destroyed. I appreciate the call, Chris.
Except if you're a lefty.
Right, well, this is true. Absolutely. I mean, the hiring, I think the real exclamation point on the case that you're making is the rehiring of Keith Olbermann. I mean, that, more than the Samantha Bee thing, that to me is the real cherry on top of the cake of arguing that there's a double standard, because that guy, if you want to talk about, you know, people being offensive, there's nothing Keith Olbermann hasn't said about not just Donald Trump, but conservatives generally. So,
yep, you're right. All right, have a good night.
Yep, you too. All right, so there's one writer over at Collider who has the temerity to argue that everything's fine with Star Wars, that there's nothing to worry about in spite of the lackluster financial performance of this latest spinoff film, Solo, A Star Wars Story. It underperformed at the box office on its opening weekend, initially projected to come in with over $130 million. The movie limped to a four-day opening of $103 million and a three-day total of just $84 million. This led the puntocracy and armchair quarterbacking to determine exactly why this happened. After all, Star Wars is supposed to be a bulletproof franchise where no entry ever flops at the box office, especially following the billion-dollar-plus worldwide grosses of The Force Awakens, Rogue One, and The Last Jedi. While we can sit here and argue about whether Solo came out too soon after The Last Jedi or whether the anthology movies are a failed endeavor, some are fretting that Solo's performance is bad for Star Wars overall. These fears are unfounded. This again from Matt Goldberg over at Collider. The first thing to remember is that Star Wars is one of the most valuable brands on the planet. The devotion of its fans is unwavering. Everyone who was bummed by the prequels still came back for The Force Awakens, and its plot points are shorthand in the popular culture. Even if someone has never seen a Star Wars movie, they probably will recognize lines like "May the Force be with you" and Yoda's unique syntax. It's ingrained in our culture, and the property is recognized worldwide. Additionally, you don't spend billions of dollars to acquire a property that could fall apart just because one movie underperformed at the box office. If there was a bellwether test, it was The Force Awakens, and that movie was incredibly well received. The second thing to recognize is that Star Wars is no longer just movies because it's a brand. It has expanded far past box office receipts. Yes, the poor box office showing for Solo does not bode well for all the Solo merchandise on shelves right now, but because Star Wars is ongoing, it doesn't really matter. If the Solo stuff doesn't sell, there will be a new movie next year, not to mention a new animated series and a new live-action TV series in the not-too-distant future. Add to that novels and comics, comic books, and you have plenty of Star Wars stories ready to feed the fan machine at a constant pace. This is largely the argument, or part of the argument, that I was making when I gave my review earlier this week of the film and talked about the state of the franchise, which I think is indicative of kind of where we're at in the culture, because so much of the backlash to Solo in particular and to Star Wars under the leadership of Disney and Kathleen Kennedy more generally is fueled by, you know, the perceived social justice warrior agenda that's been infused in this franchise, whether it's the, you know, you'll have people who complain about the female characters, whether it's your purple hair gal Holdo from this most recent one, Last Jedi, or, you know, Rey being what they call a Mary Sue, a female character who inexplicably has so much skill and didn't have to work for it, didn't have to train hard, or whatever the case may be. And of course, in this most recent one, Solo Star Wars Story, Lando Calrissian being revealed by one of the screenwriters to be a pansexual, meaning that he's turned on by literally everything, including droids and what have you. A lot of people are just not interested in having their Star Wars be something that evokes these divisive cultural debates. That's what they're trying to escape when they go to the theater. And so there's a sense of pushback against that. I hold out hope, just like this guy Max Goldberg at Collider does, that things can be turned around. It may require a change in leadership. You know, you might have to get rid of Kathleen Kennedy. You might have to bring in somebody who has more of a mindset of like a Kevin Feige, who's more focused on... Because that's the thing. The Marvel films... It's not like the Marvel films are without... Kevin Feige, in case you don't know, is the guy who's in charge of Marvel Studios, also under Disney. And he's the guy who steers the ship overall. He knows the big picture plan of where these films are going and where each film fits into the last one and where it fits into the overall scheme of where the films are building up to. There isn't a figure like that over at Lucasfilm producing these Star Wars films, and there needs to be. That would be the first thing, if I was Bob Iger in charge of Disney, that would be the first thing I would do, is clone Kevin Feige, find somebody who's just like Kevin Feige and put him in charge of Star Wars and say, it's on you now, you're in charge of it, you say which direction this thing is going to go. And the thing about Feige and the Marvel Universe is that they tackle social justice stuff too. It is there for you to see if you have a keen eye and can pick up on it, but it's not what the stories are about. And it's not the purpose of producing the films. It's something that's kind of sprinkled in there as a seasoning. And the focus is on creating an entertaining and fulfilling film populated with characters that you relate to and experiences that you enjoy. And, you know, if they can do that at Marvel, they can do that over at their sister studio of Lucasfilm as well. Closing argument, my name's Walter Hudson, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com.